It's more and more important that things that drive improved efficiencies are the things that always make it across the CFO's desk. The things that get approval are things that buy capability back. And it's a double win if you're getting more efficient while reducing risk to bad actors stealing your data, compromising your systems. No one wants that to happen.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Supply Chain Podcast. My name is Tom Raftery, and with me on the show today, I have my special guest, Mark. Mark, welcome to the podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Thanks a lot, Tom. Yeah, I'm Mark McCardle. I'm the Chief Products and Design Officer at Imprivata. And Imprivata is the leader in enabling, controlling, and monitoring digital identity in life and mission-critical industries. We just celebrated our 20th anniversary this year, and we've learned a lot about how to use digital identity to drive efficiency for users while making them and their organizations more secure. And the supply chain is a key part of our mission to improve the security of our customers' environments.
Okay.
I've been working in cybersecurity since the mid-90s, and I've seen a lot in those decades that followed. And a lot of the supply chain's critical infrastructure, it's been a frequent target by hackers.
Okay. And what do you mean when you say digital identity?
It's a great question. You know, it can be many things, but ultimately digital identity is the information that identifies an entity trying to access a resource. And it can be a person or a thing, that resource. Everyone's familiar with things like Netflix. You know, you've got a Netflix account and your user ID, which is typically your email address, and a password. Those together represent a digital identity that enables you to access Netflix and all the programming there.
Okay, cool. And I mean, you mentioned supply chain and how supply chain is increasingly vulnerable, I guess is probably the way to put it, because more and more these days, supply chains are opening up. They're, you know, allowing suppliers in or allowing buyers in. So they're more interconnected, which of course increases the threat landscape. This is the Digital Supply Chain Podcast, where we talk about things digital in supply chain, which even more focuses or even more increases as they're more digitized, the threat landscape grows even more, you have to think. And this is the first time we've had a podcast episode dedicated to supply chain security, which is entirely my fault. I should have had one long before now and several long before now. But now that we're here, can you talk to why it is that supply chains are uniquely vulnerable to threats from cybersecurity?
Well, I'm really flattered that I get to be the first person to talk about this on your podcast, because it's such an important aspect of overall cybersecurity. And if we think about hackers and their behavior, they want to access things of value. Sometimes it's cash, sometimes it's data, sometimes it's just access to systems. And they're efficient and lazy. You know, they try to not do more work than is necessary. And a lot of this, the victims, unfortunately, are opportunistic. They're just the ones that are least defended or more poorly defended, and they're the ones that require the smallest amount of effort. So if you think about, you know, a target, like say you wanted to attack a bank, because, you know, what the old banks and bank robbers used to say, that's where the money is. If you think about attacking a big bank, well, they've got thousands of really smart people in their IT teams who are focused on cybersecurity. So it's a lot of work to try and find your way in and try to access the resources that you can turn into cash for yourself. But, you know, these banks, they deal with hundreds and probably thousands of third parties. Some of them are really big, other banks, but a lot of them are going to be really small organizations that are much less sophisticated when it comes to cybersecurity. And until a few years ago, it was pretty common for big organizations to do business with smaller organizations, and there wasn't a lot of attention put into how secure they were and what protections were going to be in place for both the access and the data that these small third parties were going to have access to. And, you know, I think the Target hack, I think back in 2014, was probably one of the big headline grabbing ones, where hundreds of millions of credit card data was stolen by hackers. And they didn't go in through the front door of Target and Target's networks. They actually compromised Target through a third party, a little Pennsylvania HVAC vendor, a little small business that was, you know, doing service for for Target and a bunch of its stores to manage the heating and cooling systems. But because that small organization had poor cybersecurity practices, the hackers were able to use that connection into the Target network as the means to compromise the system. So there's been lots of examples of this, both from a hacking perspective, people looking to make money out of this, but also nation state hacks. If we look back to 2010, you know, this is an industry where really a groundbreaking, terrifying moment when something called Stuxnet was discovered. And it was the first real example of an engineered cyber weapon that was targeted at a nation state. It was a collaboration, it's believed, between the US, the NSA, and the Israeli government to bring down the Israeli nuclear program, to do it harm and set it back.
The Iranian.
The uranium plants. Yeah, this is refining uranium for weapons in Iran, and this cyber weapon was created to specifically attack a specific kind of Siemens programmable logic controller that controlled the centrifuges in these labs. It didn't destroy really anything else. It was a very targeted weapon. It managed to cross the air gap, which is a practice used to keep systems off of the internet, you know, with the thinking that if you can't connect to it over the internet, it must be more secure. And there is certainly some truth to that. But this used a USB drive. You know, everyone's got USB drives hanging around their desk. That was the vector for infection. And it had catastrophic impact on the centrifuges. So the supply chain is often the most effective way to compromise that, any target. And the financial markets, you know, the regulated markets, but regulated by the SEC in the US, they were required to start taking responsibility for third parties. And it's called vendor risk management. And that really drove a change in behavior where the due diligence performed on these smaller or larger partners that are going to be doing business with you takes into account the kind of things that are expected to protect the data and the access from evil actors.
Okay, so if I'm a supply chain manager concerned about, you know, who I'm doing business with and how secure their systems are if they're connecting to mine, should I only deal with larger organizations who are likely to have better security?
Well, it's not necessarily a question of size. I think it's a question of sophistication and the due diligence questionnaire that you typically would use, and many organizations are pretty familiar with these. If you're dealing with any regulated partners, you're going to be receiving these fairly thick cybersecurity due diligence questionnaires, as well as if you're trying to get cybersecurity insurance, you know, insurance against, you know, the downsides, the costs of being breached. The insurance companies also have very detailed prescriptive requirements that you have to meet. So there's a combination of things there. I think the culture is starting to become more broadly understanding that there is a responsibility to raise your game in terms of what you're doing to protect the assets and to protect your customers' data. And I think that's becoming more common because we're seeing CISOs, chief internet security officers, in places that we haven't seen them before.
Okay. And how does something like a digital identity help in this scenario?
Well, the thing that's probably foundational here is there's a term in the industry called zero trust, which is an approach to protecting your infrastructure and your assets from attack. Mm-hmm. And digital identity is foundational to that, because if you think about doing a transaction, the first thing that you need to know is who is the identity of the other party that you're connecting with. You want to have high assurance that you know that either it's the customer you think it is or it's the partner that you think it is. So the digital identity there becomes a really important foundational element. And then once you have that high assurance of who you're dealing with, you can now build on that. Now, what system are they connecting to me from? Is it a trusted enterprise device that's managed by our IT teams? Or is it a hotel lobby shared system with, you know, who knows what kind of malware roaming all over it? So you build trust up by assessing who you're dealing with, where they're accessing from, what's the condition of the system they're on, and then what resources are they trying to access? Is it super sensitive material? Like if it's patient health information, for instance, you would never want that on a non-trusted system. So a lot of the approaches to protecting data requires foundational digital identity.
Okay. And I assume organizations are going to need to, if they don't already, come up with kind of a digital identity strategy. What does that entail for companies?
Well, it's a great question, because this is an emerging, in many industries, this is an emerging process. The steps we took at Improvata to help our customers understand this was the creation of what we call the Digital Identity Framework. And it was built on some great thinking by organizations like NIST, analysts like Gartner, where we looked at the broad capabilities of digital identity, the things that we consider helping enable the use of digital identity. So helping users do what they need to do and get access to the things they need to access to do their jobs, controlling digital identity, which is making sure that those users have all of the entitlements and accesses that they need and nothing more. Because in cybersecurity, there's a concept called least privilege, where we want to minimize the damage that could be done by any individual account being compromised or a user going rogue by only allowing them access to the things that they specifically need to do the job and not letting them have access to everything, all the keys in the kingdom. Mm-hmm. And then the third component in the way we view digital identity is monitoring. You know, there's a lot of sensitive data that users are given access to. And there's a lot of trust being put in their hands. They're going to do the right thing. And from a compliance perspective, certainly in many industries, this has become a requirement. You have to be able to demonstrate that that data has been used responsibly and properly all the time. This is really big in healthcare, because obviously patient information is extremely sensitive information. And unfortunately, you know, there's humans are humans, and sometimes they get moments of weakness. You know, if Tom Cruise comes into the hospital and, you know, their doctor or nurse goes, oh, what's Tom in for? That's not appropriate. They're not part of the patient care team. So that's a patient privacy issue. And being able to monitor that the accesses are being used appropriately really lives up to the promise that healthcare providers make to the patients, that no harm will come to you or your data while you're under our care.
Okay. And in terms of supply chains, is there any particular industry that you work with more than another? Because supply chains go across all industries, obviously. Or is there any particular industry which is more vulnerable, you feel, than any other?
Well, we've worked a lot with healthcare in the last 20 years. That's the industry we've had the greatest success in helping absorb the complexity and enabling digital identity. But we also have a lot of customers in manufacturing, in finance, retail, aviation. So a lot of the challenges are broadly similar, but there are specific market challenges. And I think healthcare has probably got the greatest complexity and challenge, because they have hundreds of clinical applications that all require a digital identity for clinicians, doctors, and nurses to access them. There's shared devices, where in most enterprises, you're given a laptop by your employer, maybe you're given a phone, and that's your device. But in healthcare, there's a lot of shared devices, both mobile devices and shared workstations that multiple nurses or doctors are interacting with all day, every day. So that changes the dynamic in how the systems have to work. And in healthcare, again, unlike a lot of enterprises, you can't dictate and change workflows that are going to get in the way of delivering patient care. You have to make sure that when you are making them more secure, you have to drive efficiencies. You have to make the workflows that they're doing a lot more efficient. So instead of forcing them to type 15 character complex passwords every time they want to modify or enter patient data, provide a mechanism that allows strong authentication upfront, multi-factor authentication, and then have badge tap. You know, these badges that are available now, secure badges like FIDO badges, these are cryptographically secure badges that can substitute for complex passwords. So you get away from the passwords, because they're the scourge of humans, right? We're not good at remembering these long, complicated things, and there needs to be a better way. So that's really what we focus on. And that model applies to all industries, because humans, at the end of the day, most, you know, 99.999% want to do the right thing all day, every day. And we want to enable them to do that in a secure way. We also have to monitor for that tiny, tiny fraction who are going to misuse those accesses to do things that could be potentially harmful.
All right. And I assume things like using a FIDO-enabled card means it's more efficient for people entering data, because they don't have to be entering in their username. They don't have to be, you know, stamping something with a timestamp or something. It's all automatically put in for them.
That's exactly right. And that's why we've invested in capabilities like facial biometrics, you know, and other biometrics that allow a more frictionless interaction for the user to be able to get to what they need to do without fumbling and having unnecessary complexity thrust in front of them. So, you know, we want to always have a strong efficiency and cybersecurity capability matched together, because if certainly in healthcare, if you break the usability, clinicians are brilliant. They just like that Jurassic Park quote, "In nature finds a way." Clinicians always find a way around slow and bad IT practices. So that makes the organizations less secure. But ultimately, the mission for them is patient care.
Yep.
Spend time with patients, not fumbling around with technology. And the supply chain is exactly the same way.
Nice. Yep. On most episodes, I ask people if they have particular customer wins that they can speak to. Now, I realize that in the security industry, speaking of a customer win is a customer who hasn't had a break, and I'm guessing. So I assume that's a difficult question to answer, but I'll ask it anyway. Have you had any particular customer wins you can speak to?
Well, yeah, I'll speak to a theme of wins and something that's really been a driving force in our success. And that's been that we drive real return on investment. We drive real value. And cybersecurity generally is really about risk management. It's like insurance in some aspects, right? You are doing these things not because they are going to improve the top line or the bottom line. You are doing them to prevent something bad from happening. And from Privada's perspective, you know, we want to match the cybersecurity piece, which is really important, with efficiency that drives ROI. And I've had many chief information officers say to me at conferences, you know, the rolling out Imprivata's single sign-on tap and go was the greatest thing I've ever done for clinicians. They think I'm a hero for this because I've eliminated them typing those passwords that keep getting longer, more complex. You know, they're saving on average 45 minutes a shift just fumbling around with typing a username and password. Our ability to drive tap and go and eliminate and streamline those workflows buys that clinician, that end user, more time. And this applies everywhere we go. We've had manufacturing, we've got customers that instead of having people in a warehouse, you know, typing long passwords, maybe even wearing, you know, gloves and protective equipment, instead we've got a secure badge tap capability. We've got facial biometrics. So we're always looking at ways to get people to where they need to be to do their job, but do it securely and do it efficiently. And as we get into, you know, as inflation's high and, you know, lots of organizations in the economy, there's some sort of headwinds potentially coming in the next year. It's more and more important that things that drive improved efficiencies are the things that always make it across the CFO's desk. You know, the things that get approval are things that buy capability back. And it's a double win if you're getting more efficient while reducing risk to bad actors, you know, stealing your data, compromising your systems. No one wants that to happen. So we try to unite those two things every time we're engaging with the customer.
Okay. And what kind of trends are you seeing in the industry? Where do you think things are going?
Well, one of the things that we are really excited about is there's a concept in cybersecurity called privileged access management, which if you think about the most important assets inside a company's or network, the firewalls, the domain controllers, all the really expensive gear that only, you know, really high-trained, high-trusted individuals get to access to, that's become more and more important. It's, again, it's a core foundational element, and you probably can't qualify for cyber insurance if you don't have that in place. But what we recognized was there's a third-party problem here, and this directly speaks to supply chain, where you have, and it's common in many industries, certainly in healthcare, has got lots of examples where an MRI machine is not something that a hospital's IT team does maintenance and updates on. Mm. That's contracted out to Philips or GE or one of those big companies. But you've got to provide them remote access into those systems, into your network. And there's been a real messy, no, not easy. It's ad hoc. There's no visibility. It's not compliance-minded. And we've introduced SecureLink's vendor privileged access management to manage that problem in a really simple, elegant, and secure way. So you get visibility into what those third parties are doing. You control when the access is allowed, so you can make sure that your maintenance windows and systems are always available when they need to be. And you have the ability to look and see exactly what they did inside those sessions. It's sort of like a video recording of all of the vendor access actions activity. So that's been a big part of driving the ecosystem improvements. And SecureLink allows both a hospital or a manufacturer or a bank to say, if you want remote access to manage the systems inside my network, this is what you will use. But it also enables companies that have thousands of customers to use this SecureLink vendor privilege access management to remotely and securely manage all of the deployed technologies they have across their customer base. So that's a really exciting capability. It reduces the attack surface, drives a lot more efficiency, and ultimately raises the cybersecurity hygiene for all of the customers using that.
Nice. Very nice. We're coming towards the end of the podcast now, Mark. Is there any question that I haven't asked that you wish I had, or any aspect of this we haven't touched on that you think it's important for people to be aware of?
Well, I could go on for hours talking about this. There's so many examples of a cautionary tale type of examples of don't do this. But I think I'm excited that you are giving this attention, and maybe one day we can follow up and see what you're seeing from other guests you have. Talking about how cybersecurity and the supply chain are so deeply intermingled, and we can't have secure infrastructure if we're not managing the supply chain and holding it to the same levels that we hold our own systems to.
Sure, absolutely. Great. Mark, that's been really interesting. If people want to know more about yourself, Mark McArdle, or about any of the things we talked about in the podcast today, where would you have me direct them?
Well, I think the best place is our improvada.com website, and there'll be a link to that, I think, in the notes for the podcast. Mm-hmm. That's where you can find out all the amazing things that we're doing in digital identity for our customers.
Fantastic. Great. Mark, that's been really interesting. Thanks a million for coming on the podcast today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, Tom.
Okay, we've come to the end of the show. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you'd like to know more about digital supply chains, simply drop me an email to tom.raftery@outlook.com. If you like the show, please don't forget to click follow on it in your podcast application of choice to be sure to get new episodes as soon as they're published. Also, please don't forget to rate and review the podcast. It really does help new people to find the show. Thanks. Catch you all next time.